From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Can Rick Santorum go the distance? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Polls by Gallup, Pew, and the New York Times show Rick Santorum virtually tied with Mitt Romney among Republican voters. He has big leads among Tea Partiers and evangelicals in the Midwest, with Romney doing better in the West and the Northeast. As the race moves to Michigan, a victim of the recession, can Santorum shift from the cultural wars and talk the blue-collar talk about the economy? Can Romney overcome his famous advice to let Detroit go bankrupt and swamp Santorum with negative ads? On Reporter's Notebook later on, animal conservation and hunting. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Rick Santorum is the latest Republican to give Mitt Romney a scare. Can he overcome Romney's huge advantage in money and organization? As voters learn more about Santorum's record, his stand on issues, and his personality. On Reporter's Notebook, the brother of California's famous lone wolf has been killed by a hunter in Idaho as hunting itself divides the political red from the blue. First, this news update. The Taliban have said they'll only talk peace with the U.S., claiming that Afghanistan's President Karzai is no more than an American puppet. But Karzai has told the Wall Street Journal that three-way talks have been held in the past month. Laura King is based in Kabul for the Los Angeles Times. Laura King, good to have you on our program as always. What evidence do we have other than what Mr. Karzai said that there have, in fact, been three-way talks?
Well, the Taliban movement this evening issued a strenuous denial that any such contacts were taking place and renewed their assessment of the Karzai government as a puppet, calling it impotent. That kind of a denial would be expected in light of the fact that they have never accepted the Karzai government as legitimate.
Is there any way that talks could get underway without the Karzai government being involved, given America's commitment to it?
Not really. The U.S. position all along has been that these talks have to be Afghan-led. I mean, that may be a little bit of a stretch, but at the very least, there has to be Afghan participation.
Has Karzai been detailed at all about what it was that the Taliban was talking about with his organization, his government, rather, and with the United States?
He was pretty circumspect about that in the interview with the Wall Street Journal. I mean, he said that there had been a meeting within the last month involving the U.S., the Taliban, and his government. Mr. Karzai is in Islamabad, Pakistan, now, trying to revive with the Pakistanis the idea of their throwing their support behind these talks that are in a nascent stage, but which may get underway.
Is Pakistan concerned and worried that it might not be part of some ultimate deal?
Pakistan has to be part of any deal because of the fact that the Taliban leadership is based there, and there is still a lot of involvement with the Pakistani intelligence community with the Taliban. I mean, it's really not thought that talks could proceed without the approval of Pakistan.
In the meantime, of course, a lot of instability among the government leaders in Pakistan, with the Supreme Court indicating that it may go after the current administration of President Zardari. How does that affect Afghanistan?
Well, I think everyone here is watching very carefully to see what will happen with Pakistan. Certainly, the fluidity of the situation involving the current government is a matter of some concern. Although maybe the one stable thing will be the Pakistani military and the Pakistani intelligence community, and those are thought to be the real players in any talks that go forward.
What's the atmosphere like now in Kabul with the United States talking about getting out sooner rather than later?
Well, it's certainly something that is on the mind of everyone here. I think there is going to be, I think, in coming months, a real effort by Afghans who have the wherewithal and the ability to get out to possibly do so. There is just a real sense that the Western presence is drawing to a close, not immediately, but certainly on the near-term horizon.
And people with resources, you say, and the wherewithal to do it, are leaving. What consequence would that have in Afghanistan? Who would be left to run the country?
Well, it's a brain drain for sure. I mean, that people who are well off and educated, people who have got access to a second passport, they're certainly looking at their options at this point.
In the meantime, I understand that President Karzai has also been talking with Iran. What's going on there?
Well, Iran has made no secret of the fact that it wants to remain a player in this country, in this part of the world. And Mr. Karzai often uses Iran as a little bit of a bargaining chip, I suppose, in his dealings with the West and with the U.S., reminding the NATO alliance that he does have other options, and if he's in a position where things are not going well with them, that Iran is another regional power that he can look to.
And President Ahmadinejad apparently has also arrived in Pakistan. Is he going to be talking there with President Karzai?
Well, it's a summit that is meant to involve. It's meant to be a tripartite summit with Iran and with Pakistan and Afghanistan, and certainly all three of them are in touch at any given time. But this summit is an opportunity to cement that relationship.
Okay, Laura King in Kabul for the Los Angeles Times. Many thanks to you. In a moment. Can Rick Santorum go the distance? On To the Point.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, I'm only back with To the Point, with more than four national polls showing Rick Santorum now tied with Mitt Romney among Republicans. The next showdowns will be in Michigan and Arizona later this month, followed closely by 10 states on Super Tuesday on the 6th of March. Does Santorum have the resources to maintain his position? Can he shift from his emphasis on cultural issues to the economy? Michael Scheer is Washington reporter for The New York Times and chief correspondent for the Caucus blog. Michael Scheer, always good to have you on our program.
Happy to do it.
The economy was definitely on the minds of both candidates today. Apparently, Romney, in a conversation with business leaders, said that he was an outsider from Washington. He accused his own party, the Republicans, of violating principles by using earmarks and spending too much, obviously aimed at Rick Santorum. Santorum himself defended his spending record in a much-awaited speech before the Detroit Economic Club. What did he have to say?
Well, look, you know, what Rick Santorum's message is to shift back, is to try to describe himself as a broader kind of candidate, that, you know, his rivals would like to paint him as an ideological, narrow candidate that appeals only to one kind of constituency. And what Rick Santorum tried to do with the speech today and is trying to do more broadly is to describe himself as conservative, not just on social issues, but as as the best candidate to go up against Barack Obama on issues like manufacturing and reviving manufacturing, on issues like taxes, on issues like jobs and business and how to get the economy growing again. And he, you know, harkens back to his background in Pennsylvania, kind of the working class populist message that I think he thinks goes up well against Mitt Romney and his personal background.
He managed to get in one of the mistakes that Romney has made over the past few days, saying there's another candidate in the race who says he doesn't care about the very poor. He cared about the 90%, Santorum concluded. So what about the candidate who cares about everybody, obviously continuing a very tough attack on Romney?
Right. I mean, and that, you know, that is your, you know, the one of the best examples of, you know, Rick Santorum trying to become trying to become the front runner in a race by seizing on some of the missteps that Mr. Romney has made. Look, you know, for months now, I think it's been hard to describe anybody else other than Mitt Romney as the true front runner. I mean, even when Rick Perry or Newt Gingrich had kind of took the lead in some polls, it was pretty clear that Mitt Romney still was really the front runner in the race. And the question is, can Rick Santorum seize on some of the vulnerabilities that Mitt Romney has to really claim that mantle of the one to beat?
We've talked about Michigan, one of the reasons being, of course, that Romney comes from there. That's where he was born. His father was governor. He was raised there. What about Arizona? How important is that?
Well, I think it's important. I think most people are focused right now, and I think the Santorum campaign is very much focused on Michigan because I think they view it as the one that would really sting if Mitt Romney loses. If Mitt Romney were to lose Michigan, as you say, a state that he's got deep connections to, a deep tie to, and one that he won in 2008 against Senator John McCain, I think the Santorum campaign has concluded that would be a real blow. I think there's also a more self-interested reason why Santorum is not spending a lot of time in in Arizona, and that's because Mitt Romney seems to, from most of the polls there, be pretty far ahead. There's a pretty sizable Mormon population in Arizona that could be helping him. And Mitt Romney's position on illegal immigration is pretty tough. That probably helps him down there as well. So the focus, I think, is very much on Michigan. If there were to be a split decision on that Tuesday where, Mitt Romney, say, loses Michigan but wins Arizona, that also probably helps blunt some of the impact on the campaign.
Does either of these races provide delegates? So many of them have not.
No, these do. Both of these are real primaries, if we can call them that. They do allocate delegates. If Rick Santorum were to win Michigan, he would actually win delegates. The Romney campaign is going to say pretty quickly, regardless of that, as you pointed out, there's 10 or 11, I think it's actually 11 states on Tuesday, on Super Tuesday the following week, and that provides a real opportunity for Mr. Romney to use his organization, and we expect the amount of money that he has, the financial edge that he has, to try to really wrap up a bunch of delegates in that one day, which could slow whatever momentum Mr. Santorum might get.
Does Romney still have to worry about Newt Gingrich, or has he been left in the dust?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think, one of the criticisms, I think valid criticisms of the media is that we don't have a very long attention span. And the coverage has largely shifted away from Newt Gingrich and to the Santorum-Romney battle. Mr. Gingrich appears not to have a lot of money. Otherwise, he'd be spending it. He's the ads that he's doing are mostly radio ads or web videos that cost very little money. So that always is a problem. Could he have some strength in places like Georgia and elsewhere in the South where, he's proven to be pretty effective? He could. And look, we've all seen this race become so volatile and people go up and down so quickly that I don't think anybody should be quite written off yet.
Are there states in the South on Super Tuesday that might cause us all to refocus our short attention spans on Newt Gingrich?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think there are a bunch. I don't have the list in front of me, but there's a bunch in the South where he could do well. Georgia, of course, where he was a congressman for a long time. It's one of these perverse things where he probably does well in Georgia, but he probably doesn't get the bounce that he would like from there because people kind of expect him to do well. But there are a bunch of states in the South which could give him a little bit of a bump.
So what we're looking to see at the moment is whether Santorum can ride that wave from winning Colorado, Missouri, and Minnesota, regarded as upsets against Mitt Romney, and carry on.
Yeah, and there was a little bit of an indication. We've been looking at these national polls, which you mentioned at the top, which show Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum essentially tied after all of them documenting a big surge in support for Mr. Santorum over the last, week or 10 days. But today we got actually one of the first, legitimate and well-respected polls in Michigan itself, which showed a 4-point edge for Mr. Santorum over Mr. Romney. Now that's right within the poll's 4 percentage point, you know, margin of error. So it's you know, it's effectively tied. But that's pretty striking, and again, in a state where Rick Santorum has very little sort of personal connection to, and Mitt Romney does.
Again, Michael Scheer is New York Times, Washington political reporter and chief correspondent for the Caucus Blog. It's always good to have you on our program. Thanks a lot for getting us off to a good start.
Talk to you soon.
Bill Ballinger is editor of the political newsletter Inside Michigan Politics. Bill Ballinger, good to have you with us.
Glad to be with you.
Tell us more about this poll that just came out today.
Well, this one actually has it closer than four others that have come out over the last 4 days that had Santorum ahead by anywhere from 7 to 13 votes. This one had only a 4-vote spread. I wouldn't necessarily agree with your other guest that this is somehow a more credible poll. It may possibly be more credible in the sense that it might have been done a day or two later than the polls over the last 3 days, because public sentiment obviously is changing so quickly in this volatile electoral climate we're in this particular election cycle. And I think Santorum came into Michigan really just arriving today and introducing himself to the state. He's got absolutely no presence here. He's got no endorsements, no organization. For the first time, he's here. And yet he found himself in first place, I think, just coasting on the results of that 3-state win last week. And now the question is, can he close the deal here in the next 2 weeks, as your New York Times reporter was discussing, by February 28th?
Well, let's take a look at the way that the candidates are trying to change the political climate in Michigan. Gingrich, of course, and other challengers to Romney have been overwhelmed by those massive expenditures on negative ads financed by so-called independent super PACs. In Michigan, Santorum is now running an ad featuring a Romney lookalike, really does look like Romney, with a paint gun that shoots mud at Santorum and misses every time. You really have to see it, but here's how it sounds.
Romney and his super PAC have spent a staggering $20 million brutally attacking fellow Republicans. Why? Because Romney's trying to hide from his big government Romney care and his support for job-killing cap and trade. And in the end, Mitt Romney's ugly attacks are going to backfire.
And then at the end, the gun misfires and Romney gets the mud on him. Meantime, with GM and Chrysler now showing profits after massive federal assistance, Romney's trying to live down that New York Times op-ed piece in 2008 that was headlined, "Let Detroit Go Bankrupt."
How in the world did an industry and its leaders and its unions get in such a fix that they lost jobs, that they lost their future? President Obama did all these things the liberals have wanted to do for years. The fact that you've got millions of Americans out of work, home values collapsing, people here in Detroit are distressed.
I want to make Michigan stronger and better. Michigan's been my home, and this is personal.
Bill Ballinger, back to you with Inside Michigan Politics. GM just released some pretty impressive figures, and even Chrysler is making a profit.
Well, absolutely. Barack Obama and the Democratic Party nationally and here in Michigan have been actually pounding Mitt Romney about this for the last couple of months, claiming that Romney was dead wrong in his opposition to the federal bailout 3 years ago, and that it has worked, and the Obama administration and the Democrats in Congress were correct in making a decision to offer federal assistance. Romney came back with an editorial this week in the Detroit News, again, kind of almost doubling down on his New York Times editorial 3 years ago and saying, you know, I still think I was right. I think that what should have been allowed to happen is GM and Chrysler went through a structured bankruptcy, he called it, and emerged whole again, and that they would be just as robust and healthy now if they'd done it that way, and you wouldn't have the intrusion of the federal government and federal tax dollars, taxpayer tax dollars involved, and you wouldn't have the heavy influence of the unions through what Romney described as crony capitalism involved in the management of the company. So that's what he said, and I'll just add one thing more. Rick Santorum spoke this noon to the Detroit Economic Club, and everybody waited to see whether he would say anything different from Mitt Romney. And in fact, all he did was pretty much underscore what Mitt Romney said about the auto bailout. And he was met with stony silence from the assembled businessmen in the crowd here in Michigan. So, you know, there weren't any cheers for Rick Santorum's position if anybody thought it might be more Obama-like than Romney's.
Isn't it true that there are those who are saying that the structural bankruptcy that Romney's talking about couldn't possibly have happened without federal money because there wasn't any private money around? And as regards to crony capitalism with the unions, the unions gave up a lot, didn't they?
Yeah, I'm not, you know, taking sides.
No, I didn't mean to. Neither am I.
I'm just saying, yes, you're absolutely right. That is what the Democrats are saying. And actually, you can make a very strong factual and intellectual argument that the private capital simply was not available, and that if GM and Chrysler had been forced to go through a structured bankruptcy, they never would have emerged. They would have been liquidated, and there would be no domestic auto industry, or at least maybe only Ford, and that it would have been a disaster, and that Romney was dead wrong. And that is the argument they're making. And here's the point. If Romney is the Republican nominee, that will be a big issue here in Michigan. Maybe it will nationally as well, but especially here in Michigan. But in this primary, the whole point is this is a Republican primary, even though, by the way, independents and Democrats can invade the primary and vote on February 28th if they want to. But it's primarily going to be Republicans. And frankly, the other three candidates, Gingrich, Santorum, and Paul, don't disagree with Romney on this. So there is no real difference of opinion between the four of them on that issue.
Given the stony silence at the Detroit Economic Club, it would seem that maybe any Republican might have a real challenge in Michigan. Would you interpret it that way?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, no Republican has carried Michigan at the presidential level since George H.W. Bush beat Mike Dukakis in 1988. So all things being equal, Republicans have a terrible time winning Michigan anyway. So, you know, the wind is in their faces, and, you know, maybe outstate in Michigan, the automobile company bailout by the federal government won't hurt the Republican nominee that much. But among people in Metro Detroit, which is where the auto industry is centered, and with a lot of business and automotive executives sitting there in the crowd today listening to Santorum and reading what Mitt Romney has written in the past, you know, they can't feel
okay.
Too good.
We got to take a break. We'll come right back and hear what Santorum, who so far until today hasn't had much of a presence in Michigan, is going to be able to show them. We'll hear from somebody from Philadelphia, where a Santorum, of course, was a U.S. senator on Reporter's Notebook, saving wolves in Oregon and California, gunning them down in Idaho. To the Point.
Subscribe to the To the Point podcast at kcrw.com or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find To the Point on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
Warman Olney back with To the Point, talking about Rick Santorum apparently catching up with Mitt Romney, even in Michigan, where Santorum is hardly known at all, and where Romney was born, and where his father was governor. Santorum obviously trying to change the subject, as we heard earlier in the program, from the cultural issues that he has emphasized so much in the past to economics. But here's one of the cultural issues that he has talked about that might get him in trouble, particularly with women. This comes from a 2006 interview about birth control.
I don't think it works. I think it's harmful to women. I think it's harmful to our society to have a society that says that, you know, sex outside of marriage is something that should be encouraged or tolerated, particularly among the young. And I think it has, we've seen very, very harmful long-term consequences to a society. So birth control to me enables that, and I don't think it's a healthy thing for our country.
John Baer is political columnist with the Philadelphia Daily News. He covered Santorum's 12 years in the U.S. Senate. John Baer, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Is that pretty typical, Santorum?
It's very typical, and one of the things that I thought would happen after Iowa, and I wrote about this after he came in second, and we later learned he won by 0.1%, was that if people take a look at him, I thought after Iowa people would take a look at him, they would actually see some of the things he said and done in the past, some of the things he'd stand for, and that would be the end of his campaign. Well, that didn't happen, primarily because after Iowa he vanished. I mean, he finished, you know, tied for third in New Hampshire, third in South Carolina, third in Florida, fourth in Nevada. And then all of a sudden, we have these two small caucuses and a one non-binding primary, which 15, 20 years ago would not even be covered by the national press. And suddenly, he's the front runner.
He's the front runner in the polls. Are you suggesting that is purely a creation of the media coverage?
I am. I think that Mitt Romney is going to spend a lot of money introducing him to Michigan in the next 2 weeks, and I think that the national media now will start to focus more attention on him, and that once the entire Rick Santorum package comes out, he'll look a lot less attractive than he might today.
He was elected twice in Pennsylvania. That's a big state and a very diverse one. What is it about his Santorum's stands, that you think will end his campaign once more people know about him?
Well, I think he was elected in Pennsylvania because every state has anomalies sometimes. I mean, our state has traditionally elected moderate Republicans both to the governorship and to the United States Senate. He really was an anomaly. He's the most conservative senator that we've ever had. And I think the same sorts of things that caught up with him in 2006 in Pennsylvania will still catch up with him. I mean, yes, he lost because George W. Bush was not popular, the war was not popular, but that campaign in 2006, where he was, a lot of people forget this, he was the third-ranking Republican in the United States Senate. I mean, he was a member of Republican leadership, and he got blown out in Pennsylvania. And for large measure, in large measure because of some personal stuff, a couple of the issues in the campaign were that he was living in Virginia in a million-dollar house and homeschooling his kids, but charging a school district in Pittsburgh to do so. He had gotten elected in 1990 to the U.S. House by criticizing the incumbent for living in Virginia and being out of touch. And yet, by the time he got his taste of Washington, he was doing exactly the same thing. So there's been this long pattern of kind of say one thing, do another, that I think is going to not play all that well.
What about Romney's charge today that he didn't mention Santorum by name, but he said that the Republicans, and this was his part of his argument as being an outsider, Republicans in Washington violated their principles with earmarks and big spending and so on. Does that apply directly, do you think, to Santorum?
In as much as any candidate uses revisionist history to apply to things that happened in the past, Santorum was part of something that everybody did at the time. He was very involved in getting earmarks for Pennsylvania. He learned at the feet of a master. The senior senator at the time was Arlen Specter, who was famous for bringing back tons of money and federal projects to the state. Santorum was very involved in what became known as the K Street Project, where incumbent senators and their staffs would hook up with lobbyists and feed staff members into big lobbying firms. Santorum benefited greatly from those connections after he left the Senate by being hired as board members and being hired as consultants for firms that he worked with as a senator and for firms that benefited from legislation he sponsored as a senator. All of that, I assume, Governor Romney will bring to bear either in his own ads, in his PAC ads, or during the upcoming debate in Arizona, that again will educate people to Santorum being a little bit less than what he pretends to be.
John Baer, political columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News, covered Rick Santorum during his 12 years in the Senate and since. Richard Land is with us. He's president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention. Richard Land, always good to have you on our program.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you. I've enjoyed the conversation so far.
Glad to hear that, and it's good to have you join it. You have been part of or been to meetings of of evangelical conservatives who are looking over these candidates.
Evangelical and Catholic.
And Catholic. Thank you very much for adding that very important element to the conversation. Where does that group stand? I know you yourself don't endorse, but where does that group stand now with regard to Rick Santorum?
Well, they came to Texas to try to coalesce around a conservative candidate as soon as they could, and I think they were rather shocked. I know I was, that they were able to coalesce that weekend around Rick Santorum with a substantial consensus, 75% in the end, uniting behind him. And they went home. These are all grassroots organizations. They went home. They planted grass. They fertilized it, and now the grass is growing. We saw some of it being harvested in those three primaries last week.
What is it that appeals to the evangelicals and to the Catholics about Rick Santorum? We did hear his one statement about his dubious attitude toward birth control.
Well, while Catholics and evangelicals disagree about birth control, he's made it very clear that he's not trying to impose his views on birth control on the country. He's been a staunch pro-life, pro-traditional marriage, pro-social issues person. He would carry our water in the Senate when no one else would. He has been he's a strong supporter of the faith-based initiatives. He and J.C. Watts held a leadership forum for faith leaders when the faith-based initiatives was first started. He's got foreign policy credentials, 12 years on the Armed Services Committee. That's an issue in a world that's being racked by terror, and of the four people who are running, he's got more foreign policy expertise and experience than any of the others that are running. And so, people looked at his position and looked at the others, and they basically came to the conclusion that all of the candidates had strengths and weaknesses, but his weaknesses were easier to fix. His weaknesses were, number one, he wasn't that well known, and number two, he was underfunded. That's a lot easier to fix than Newt Gingrich's 56% negative ratings.
What about statements that he's made comparing homosexual sex to bestiality, saying there should be laws against sodomy and adultery, calling the Catholic priest sex scandal a result of Boston liberalism? Does that go down well with the constituency that you're talking about, Richard Lynn?
Not most. I mean, most of them were opposed to homosexual marriage or same-sex marriage, and they support his stance about that. But you'd get a range of views about, I don't think adultery should be illegal. I don't think that consensual homosexual behavior between consenting adults in private should be illegal. But I do think that marriage ought to be reserved for a man and a woman.
Okay. Let me go back to John Baer over the Philadelphia Daily News. What was the record of Mr. Santorum when he was on the Armed Services Committee?
Well, I mean, he was a traditional hawkish sort of conservative Republican senator and very supportive of President Bush, for example, very supportive of the war in Iraq, both going in and staying in. So, I mean, there's nothing in those areas that will separate him in terms of the Republican primary. It probably won't help him with moderate independent voters in a general election should he be the nominee, but it shouldn't be an issue for him in the primary.
Let me go back to Bill Ballinger with the political newsletter Inside Michigan Politics, with Michigan being the next big challenge for Rick Santorum. How does what we just heard from Richard Land, Bill Ballinger, do you think will sound to voters in Michigan?
Well, I think what John said could be used against Santorum in attack ads by Romney. I mean, if, for instance, the homeschooling thing where maybe it's being subsidized by Pittsburgh taxpayers or whatever, if that can be somehow formulated in an ad, that could be hurtful. There are other things perhaps in Santorum's record involving spending, some of them that didn't, necessarily hurt him in the 2006 re-election campaign in Pennsylvania, but could in a Republican primary here in Michigan on February 28th, such as raising the debt ceiling and earmarks and a lot of stuff like that. That could hurt him, where Romney will be emphasizing that. And Romney has the advantage of being a state-based executive in Massachusetts who never served a day in public office in Washington and doesn't have any of that stuff in his record.
Richard Land, back to you with the Southern Baptist Convention. What about all of the list of things that John Baer gave us earlier about the homeschooling being subsidized, about saying one thing, doing another in various issues? Are evangelicals and Catholics going to be looking at that kind of critique as it emerges, as it no doubt will, from the national reporters as this campaign
goes
on?
Well, one thing, of course, that wasn't mentioned about his record on the Armed Services Committee is he's been a consistent and staunch supporter of Israel, which is absolutely critical to the evangelical community. And in a general election campaign would be a tremendous contrast with Mr. Obama. When it comes to homeschooling, a lot of Catholic and evangelical parents homeschool, so they certainly want someone who's sympathetic to homeschooling.
But they don't have it subsidized by somebody else.
No, they don't. But they would certainly, most of them would support tuition credits and vouchers for people who want to send their children to non-public schools. Whether they send them to homeschools or not, they think that that's fair, and that it's as long as Zelman v. Simmons Harris is the law of the land, it's constitutional, because the aid would go to parents, and the parents would decide how they want to spend it. And dissatisfaction with the public schools is very, very high, especially among the working class. And one thing that hasn't been mentioned here, as prominently as it should be, is that Rick Santorum comes from the blue-collar working class. As the Wall Street Journal says, his economic plans are trickle-down economics for the blue collars, and he wants to give tax breaks to factories that are actually making things as opposed to those that aren't. He wants to give substantial tax breaks to families and people who are raising families, revaluing families and revaluing child-rearing in the tax code. Those are things that are going to play very well, not just for the Republican voters, but with blue-collar Reagan Democrats in the old Rust Belt.
Bill Ballinger, Michigan, not maybe part of the old Rust Belt, but pretty rusty at the moment. How's that going to go down?
Well, I think Mr. Land is making a better case for Rick Santorum than Rick Santorum did in his speech to the Economic Club this noon. But I think Rick Santorum, and this underscores what Mr. Land just said, is trying to emphasize his rather populist, common-touch, blue-collar background and posture. And he's pointing out, by the way, with the release of his income tax returns this week, that, you know, he paid taxes at twice the rate of Mitt Romney, and that, you know, he can identify with a little guy. So, you know, that in general is the way he's trying to position himself here in Michigan, which I think is something he needs to do, because he needs to be seen as something other than a one-dimensional social cultural conservative. I mean, there's no way Mitt Romney is going to get to the right of Rick Santorum on social cultural issues. That's a given. But he needs to stake out some kind of a difference between himself and Romney here in Michigan on economic fiscal issues that's going to be more appealing to a February 28th primary electorate in Michigan. And I'm not sure he can do that, and I'm not sure he did it today.
Richard Land, is it good for the Republican Party for this dispute to continue, and for each of them to be pointing out the negatives of the other? It's often said that they're providing all the ammunition that the Obama campaign will need. Or do you think it's healthy?
Well, I think up to a point it's healthy. I think competition is healthy. I think that what they're saying about each other is rather mild compared to what Senator Obama and Senator Clinton were saying about each other in 2008, and that worked out rather well. I think, for instance, Romney's a better candidate than he was 6 months ago because of having to respond to the critique. And I think that up to a point, it becomes a strength. Beyond a certain point, and beyond a certain point of negativity, I think there's a law of diminishing returns, but I don't think we've reached that yet.
John Baer, you've listed some of the problems that Santorum is going to be facing from a substantive point of view. What about his resources? Can he really hang in there, particularly given that 10 or 11 states are going to be coming up so very soon all over the country on Super Tuesday?
Well, you just hit it on the head. I mean, I can think he can hang in there as long as it's a state-by-state contest. The problem for him is Super Tuesday because you have he is running a state-by-state campaign, and he's running against a nationally organized campaign. The other thing I'd note on that is that within that national organization, there are an awful lot of top-tier Republicans, certainly here in Pennsylvania, some that I've talked to, that have held back on support on vocal support, on endorsements, on monetary support for Mitt Romney, particularly in Pennsylvania, because they don't want to tick people off in the party, particularly like elected officials in the legislature who still support Santorum. So the real test, you're absolutely right, is going to be on Super Tuesday, when we see if the Santorum campaign is broad enough and deep enough to provide some kind to attract some kind of support in multiple states and multiple parts of the country. We know the Romney campaign is already in place.
Richard Land, the evangelical and Catholic communities do have people with considerable funding in them. Do you think that somebody's going to come up with enough to provide a super PAC that might work on Mr. Santorum's behalf, particularly if he does well in Michigan and Arizona?
Well, I think that more than that, it's going to be the grassroots organization, particularly in those southern states. For instance, I think he's got a better than 50-50 chance of winning Tennessee and winning Oklahoma. And he's going to do well in southern states because of his stance on issues. And frankly, I think if he wins Michigan, it's a jump ball game. Up until now, he's got a 20-30% chance of winning the nomination. But if he wins Michigan in this 24/7 news cycle kind of world in which we live, it's a new ball game.
If he loses, is he out of business?
No, but I think that Romney remains the overwhelming favorite if he retains Michigan. But if Romney loses what is perceived to be his home state the week before Super Tuesday, then I think that that will propel Santorum into an even match with Romney on Super Tuesday.
Richard Land, President of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention. John Baer with the Philadelphia Daily News. Quick response. Do you agree with what we just heard from Richard Land?
I think he's absolutely right. Look, as I mentioned earlier, when you have somebody win a couple of meaningless caucuses and a non-binding primary and get catapulted into first place nationally in the polls, if they actually win a state with a real primary and delegates and a big state and an important state, they'll probably have him, though the national media will have him being an inaugurated next week.
Now, Bill Ballinger, what do you say?
I tend to agree with your other two guests, except that if Romney loses Michigan, I think even though it would make Romney's nomination no more than a 50-50 bet, I'm not sure Rick Santorum is going to be the beneficiary. I think it would be actually more likely that you'd see an entry of another candidate, a Jeb Bush, a Chris Christie, or a Mitch Daniel, one of these guys who has not entered the fray at this point. I think the super PACs and the Karl Roves of the world will get together and decide, Mitt can't close the deal, we got to go somewhere else because we can't allow Santorum or Gingrich to be our nominee.
Bill Ballinger with a newsletter, Inside Michigan Politics. Thanks to you all, also to our previous guest, Michael Scheer of the New York Times. Good to have all of you with us today. A young wolf tagged OR7 in the state of Oregon grew up and found his way to California, captivating animal lovers worldwide. OR9, another male from the same litter, went the other way to be killed by a hunter in Idaho. We'll have more on that in a moment and what the political consequences might be on To the Point.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @to_the_point_kcrw.
Warman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The animal tagged OR7 became known around the world as the Lone Wolf of California, the first to be seen in the wild in this state in almost 90 years. In Idaho, it's been a different story. When OR9's dead body was photographed, Idaho's Governor Butch Otter congratulated the hunter, even though the kill was technically illegal. Rocky Barker is environmental reporter for the Idaho Statesman, and he's author of Scorched Earth, How the Fires of Yellowstone Changed America. Rocky Barker, good to have you on our program.
Good to talk to you, Warren.
What was illegal about this killing?
Well, it really wasn't that big a deal. He
had a tag for 2011, and the clerk told him that it was still good until March because our wolf season runs for another month. And so he goes out and he shoots this wolf, and he comes back in and takes it to the wardens, and they say, well, you don't have a legal tag. But he tells the story, and they let him off with a warning.
The governor of Idaho, whom I just mentioned, Butch Otter, made a very sarcastic comment about this to the governor of Oregon.
Yes, he apologized, but, you know, he was really not seriously apologizing. It was tongue-in-cheek. He offered to give Governor Kitzhaber 150 wolves from Idaho.
So there's a very different view here, obviously, of wolves, for which there is a season in Idaho, and then there is in Oregon and California. How do you explain that?
You know, there's a lot of people in Idaho, just like there are in California, who just think shooting wolves is a terrible thing. But most people in Idaho think hunting wolves is a good thing, even people who like wolves, because they think that they're managing them. There is a contingent that just never wanted him here in the first place, of which Governor Otter is a part of, you know. And there are people who feel very strongly on both sides. It's a very polarizing issue.
Explain how killing wolves is managing them.
Well, you know, we have big game. We have mountain lions and bears. That the idea is that you want a certain number, and then there's a certain number that they consider surplus. This is old game management, going back to Aldo Leopold. But shooting predators has always been much more, it's a very sensitive issue in almost anywhere in the country, because people don't think of, you know, going out and eating a predator like you would do an elk, for instance.
Well, now,
and so...
Go ahead. No, go ahead
and
finish your thought.
Well, and so people, Idaho's Fish and Game Department, their biologists are managing wolves, both to make sure that we have a sustainable population of wolves, but also they believe that the wolves are reducing the number of elk. And so that's, and then there are, of course, many people in Idaho think they are, using a word I hate, decimating the elk population, which the facts don't bear out.
Okay. What about the politics of this? And why would the governor of Idaho make a nasty crack in the form of an apology to the governor of Oregon and take the position that he did? Does that suggest that Idaho is a hunting state, is always going to be a hunting state, and you get elected by being a hunter?
Well, absolutely. Butch Otter... got nothing but votes with this, and I think what he was doing was a little bit more PR. Journey, the wolf you talked about that's gone into California, has gotten international attention, and so now suddenly there's a side of on the other side. He's gonna play the attention that is coming to this wolf by the fact that the brother was killed in Idaho. And, you know, he's getting that attention. Of course, we're talking about it, but conservative publications like the Washington Times were jumping on board with him.
What about the wolf and the ecosystem? There's been a program to reintroduce wolves, predators being necessary. You yourself have written about the impact of a single wolf. Does this all raise awareness about the importance of these animals?
It does. Wolves, you know, when I was there when they released the wolves in 1995, and I wrote a couple of stories about two of the wolves that they released that first year, who lived a long time, like almost 15 years, and really made a difference in the politics of wolves here in the West. But ecologically, they're changing the ecosystem in Yellowstone. We're seeing... we're seeing brush come back along their creeks. It changes, it reverberates throughout the ecosystem when you bring back a major predator like this. It's been an incredible, impact all across, both ecologically, politically, all kinds of socially. And I think you would find that there's a lot more people who tolerate wolves in Idaho today than would have maybe 4 years ago when they were listed and when there wasn't a hunting season.
Doesn't sound, though, as if Governor Barker's gotten the message.
Well, no, I admit it. I love wolves, and I'm glad we've got them back. And and the governor asked me personally why I hadn't bought a wolf tag, and I told him I just couldn't see shooting a wolf.
And what did he tell you?
Well, he was very disappointed.
Okay.
Just because he knows I hunt. I do hunt elk and deer and birds, and, you know, I don't have any problem with that.
But no wolves.
Not yet. No, I don't think so. I don't think that'll happen.
All right. Rocky Barker, environmental reporter for the Idaho Statesman, author of Scorched Earth, How the Fires of Yellowstone Changed America. It's great to have you on our program.
Good to be back, Warren.
Today's program produced by Sonia Geis with Karen Radziner and Katie Cooper. Our technical director is Wesley Roberts. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.